Succession number 20894, Reel 5.
Eddie Jones, Reel 5.
We should have gone into Dover, but there was a problem at Dover and we had to go to New Haven. And eventually we got to London, and I eventually got home to Hereford on leave, and that was 7 days from the time I'd left the regiment. I had 7 days at home, and I had to report back . I had to be at Victoria Station at 6 o'clock in the evening. And I left Hereford at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and got up to Paddington, crossed over to Victoria. When I got to Victoria, I discovered that they'd extended my leave by 24 hours, owing to the very rough weather in the Channel. So I didn't know quite what to do, and I'd met an old friend of mine on the way up, and we decided to go home again. But we couldn't get a train from Paddington back to Hereford, so we went to Euston and caught a train to Crewe, and a train from Crewe to Hereford. Got in Hereford at 4 o'clock in the morning. I got home. The family had heard the announcement on the BBC that there had been a leave extension, and I had breakfast with my father and mother, had a sleep in a chair for a couple of hours, and back to the station to catch a train back again. We got back to Victoria that night, moved down to New Haven, and caught the ferry across to Calais, and then the train from there to the new transit camp at Gennep, which was in Holland. The other transit camp had closed, and it had moved up to Gennep. And we got there, and it was in a terrible state. It was rain, there was mud everywhere, duckboards everywhere, and no transport to take us on from there. And I spent about 3 days trying to get transport to take us back up to the regiment. Eventually, a truck did turn up, and we all piled aboard, and away we went, and it was a devil of a long journey, because since I'd left the regiment, they'd moved from the Dartmoor-Ems Canal up onto the River Elbe. I eventually got back to the regiment, and it had taken me 7 days from the time I'd left home to get back to the regiment. I discovered that A Company, which was my company, were the only company that were forward. All the rest were back some miles from the River Elbe. And I wasn't allowed to go up until after dark, when they took the ration truck up. I went up with the ration truck, and eventually I found my platoon, who were billeted in a cottage some 200 yards from the river, River Elbe. Fortunately, they'd built a very large flood bank all along the River Elbe there, so that the Germans had to fire over this flood bank, and they were missing the village that we were in. I forget the name of the village. But I took over from my friend Bob, and he had to go and take over 9 platoon, because the chap who had 9 platoon had been wounded. And we were there for about 4 days, and eventually pulled back, and then eventually we crossed the Elbe. And I remember, as we were going across the Elbe, there was a Bailey Bridge had been built across the river. We crossed on the Bailey Bridge. And as we were in the middle of the bridge, from out of the blue come a Stuka dive bomber. And he came straight down on top of us, and he dropped a bomb which fell about 100 yards down the river from the bridge. He finished up himself in the river. He was shot down by the anti-aircraft gun. And we moved up, and we had a couple of days skirmishing. You couldn't call it fighting. And we eventually came to an autobahn, and we were crossing the autobahn, and a Messerschmitt 262 came tearing across the country and loosed 2 rockets go at us that the convoy had missed. I was travelling on the back of the first tank, and as we came to a rise in the road, to the left we spotted some smoke. And we sat there for quite a time, watching this smoke, and it was moving from the left to the right. And we realised it was a train. And when we got the binoculars on it, we realised it was an armoured train. It had about 4 88s and loads of small guns. And the tank commander gave the range to the big gun in the tank, which was depressed, and fired and hit the engine right smack in the middle of the boiler, which blew up and went down the embankment. They were on an embankment. And we moved on.
This was a Comet tank, was it?
A Comet, yep. We had the Comets by then, yeah.
Did you prefer those to the...
Oh, yeah, they were much lower and much faster, of course, you know. They had they downgraded the gun, actually, because the Shermans were originally fitted with a 75 millimeter gun. But one in three of our Shermans had a 17-pounder anti-tank gun fitted in the turret, which would knock out a Tiger tank. But of course, they were always vulnerable to be knocked out themselves because they had this massive gun sticking out. The Germans could see that, and obviously went for the Firefly, as they were called, the Firefly Sherman, before they went to the 75s. But the Comet had a gun which was slightly less powerful than the 17-pounder. But it had better armour, and it was much faster and much lower on the ground, of course, you know, which was, it was an updated Cromwell tank, actually, the Comet one. Anyway, we eventually got to the outskirts of a small town called Bad Odesloe. By then we realised that the war was almost over. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of civilians coming down the roads, escaped prisoners of war, Russians. And while I was away on leave, of course, the division had captured Belsen concentration camp, which I didn't know anything about until after I got back. But the amount of...
What do you mean you didn't do anything about?
I didn't know anything about that until I got back from leave. I remember that when I was coming back off leave, we got to the RASC supply point, and a woman came, a German, she came with terribly distressed, saying that her daughter was being raped by Russians. So we went up this little lane which led to the cottage where they lived to see if we could do something about it. There were four of us. And when we got up there, the Russians had gone, but the girl was dead. They'd cut her throat. And also in the fields, just by where we were in this supply point, there were all these various escaped prisoners of war from all over the world, I should think it was. And there was a group of them. They had a circular saw blade mounted on a few bricks with a fire underneath, and they were making kind of flapjacks. And one of these leant over and to take a flapjack off the plate, and the chap who was turning him over with a big dagger just stabbed him for taking this cake off the plate. Killed him straight out like that.
Did you see this?
Yeah, right in front of us that was. Yeah. And I said to the friend I was with, I think it's time we moved out from here. It looks a bit dangerous, don't you? But as I say, we eventually got to the outskirts of Bad Odesloe. And I was on the second tank, I think it was. And we came up the road, and there was a German major stood on the corner of the road. And he came over and he spoke to the CO who was on the first tank and said to him, could he send someone to capture to take his men as prisoners? And the colonel came over and he said, Son Jones, take a couple of men and go with this German officer down this side road to a school. He's got 300 men he wants to surrender. So I went with him and he spoke perfect English. And he said, I'm thankful the war is nearly over. We got down there and there were 300 Germans in the playground of this school. And they'd thrown all their weapons in a big heap in the middle of the playground. All their rifles and revolvers and all sorts. So I said to him, I'd get him on the road and march him back. And we brought him back up onto the main road and told him to keep going back. You know, you just couldn't spare men to look after prisoners. You had to just make your own way back. And they did. You know, the war was over to them. And then we moved into Bad Odesloe. And we took over the town. And I set up my headquarters in a cafe. My platoon headquarters in a cafe. And we did patrols all around the, looking for any stray Germans and what have you. A corporal came to me and he said, the man who's opposite has got a distillery. And he's terrified because the Russians keep breaking in and stealing his the spirits he brews or distilled. So I said, right, well, put a sentry on there and tell them that if anybody tries to break in, don't ask questions, just shoot them. And then a lady, another corporal came to me and he said, the lady up the street had a bakery and the Russians kept breaking in and stealing all the bread she was baking for the civilians. So I did the same there, and the lady sent me a lovely basket of bread down that night. This lady sent me a basket of bread down. But when the war eventually finished, which was on the, we knew about on the 7th of May, we heard that the war had finished. And I said to this corporal, right, go and see your friend in the distillery. I want a couple of bottles over here to celebrate. He come back, he said, there ain't nothing in there, it's all empty bottles. We've been guarding him, not his distillery. I remember the CO sent for everybody, all the senior NCOs, to go and have a celebratory drink at battalion headquarters with him. And the day after, I was ordered to go on an advance party. Oh no, we moved from there a few miles north to a small village. And I was ordered to go on the advance party into Flensburg to take over the barracks at Flensburg. And there was a captain and about 20 or 30 men and myself, a couple more sergeants. We went and we took over this barracks. It was a marine barracks at Flensburg. And there were still about 50 marines there, which we used to do a lot of work. Repair windows, repair doors and make the barracks presentable for the battalion to move in, which they did about a week later. The battalion moved into the barracks about a week later. And that was the end of the story, as far as the war was concerned. We were there for... Flensburg was very nice. It hadn't been touched by the war.
So coming back to that incident in which the girl was violated, you mean the Russians had just raped her and cut her throat?
Yeah. Yeah, she was only about 16. She was dead.
What was her mother's reaction?
Oh, she was absolutely beyond herself, you know, screaming and shouting. But that was going on quite regularly then. It was terrible.
What kind of house was this?
It was only a cottage. Little cottage it was.
And there were just the two of them?
Just the mother and a daughter living there, I assume. I never saw anybody else, no. But, the roads were absolutely jam-packed with all these what we call DPs. They were displaced persons. They were civilians, come from concentration camps, broke out of concentration camps. And, of course, there were a lot of released soldiers and airmen from prisoner of war camps that had been released, you know. Because towards the end of the war, we were coming across camps at very regular intervals all through the... towards the end of the war. Some of them, one camp we held all American airmen, we released that. Another was, there were all Yugoslavs and all nationalities in some of these camps. And of course we'd never been told anything about concentration camps, so when we came across these camps, it amazed us to see how bad they were, you know. We'd never heard the word concentration camp.
But were you liberating prisoner of war camps or
both.
Concentration camps?
Well, we liberated Belsen. As I say, I wasn't actually there. I was on leave then. But we did liberate several prisoner of war camps, which mainly the Germans had pulled out and just left for place wide open, you know. my pal Bob, he was at Belsen, and he said they didn't see it because Belsen was typhus-ridden, and before they got into the camp, they stopped. There was a truce held with the Germans, apparently, to bypass the camp so that they could then get in medical aid to try and sort out the problem that was in the camp itself. There was no actual atrocities carried out at Belsen, although there were thousands of dead there. It was mainly through starvation that they died, because the living and the dead were in the same huts, you know. They had to sort it all out. And they managed to get all the medical aid they could from the army and Americans, and got Lord knows who came in there to try and sort it all out. But as I say, I didn't see any of that because I was still on leave when that happened.
So once VE Day came, you were in the occupation of Germany?
Yes.
What did that consist of?
Well, that consisted mainly of this barracks at Flensburg, which are very nice, on the outskirts of the town. Brigade headquarters were in the town itself, and we used to have to do guard at brigade headquarters. And when you were a duty company, you used to get calls for problems with, there were numerous DP camps in the town, these displaced persons living anywhere, in allotments, anywhere they could live. And there were lots of fights going on, mainly between men over women. That's what most of the fights were. And we used to have to go down and sort it all out. And we didn't used to take a rifle, we used to take the handle of pickaxes and use those. They're very effective.
Did you have to actually use them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Going to these POW camps.
POW?
No, they were displaced person camps. That's right. They weren't POWs. They were just like nomads. They were. They come from all over Europe. A lot of problems there. And we were in Flensburg for about 6 months, I suppose. Eventually, we moved down to Kleve on the German-Dutch border, because Flensburg is about a couple of miles off the Danish border, North Germany, North Schleswig-Holstein. And we moved down to Kleve, and we were there for about 6 months. And we moved down from Kleve to Krefeld, and I had another 6 months there, and then from Krefeld to Iserlohn, and I was eventually demobbed from Iserlohn. That's where I left.
What were relations like with German civilians during the...
Well, at the start, you weren't allowed to talk to Germans at all. There was a non-fraternization ban, which was almost impossible to enforce, people being what they are, nature being what it is. And after about 3 or 4 months of that, they lifted the non-fraternization ban. And because, I mean, chaps were going out with German girls anyway. And they realised that the non-fraternization ban didn't work. One of the things you were taught not to do, or told not to do, was if you met a German walking along the street, you never stepped off the pavement to let him pass. You made him step off the pavement. And at Flensburg especially, there were a devil of a lot of Germans walking about there in uniform. they were, because Flensburg had been apparently a hospital town. And there was more damage done to Flensburg after the war than what there was during the war, because they had a ship blew up in the harbour there, loading up sea mines. Ship blew up in the harbour there after we had occupied the town. And I was on my way to breakfast, because the sergeant's mess wasn't in the camp. It was down the road in a private house. About 8 o'clock in the morning, I was on my way to breakfast, and this terrific explosion, which blew all the leaves off the trees, and we didn't know what had happened until later in the day. We found out a ship had blown up in the harbour. And we went down that night, got a couple of jeeps and went down to see what had happened. And the ship was turned upside down in the harbour. And the bottom, it was like a colander. All these mines had blown up.
You said that during the Northwest Europe campaign, that your worst time was those 2 days in Operation Goodwood.
Yes, I think that would be the worst time, as regards the amount of pressure we were under. Yes.
Was there a second worst time?
Well, I suppose Baron was the next worst, the first action we fought. That was the worst two. Because once we got the enemy moving out of Normandy, I mean, the D-Day was on the 6th of June, and it was about the 29th of August before we actually got the Germans moving out of Normandy. So there was a hell of a struggle there. And, of course, the country wasn't good tank country. It was very, very close country, very wooded, deep lanes, and it wasn't good tank country at all. I mean, the bocage of Normandy was terrible. You got into these little tiny fields which were surrounded by high banks with hedges on top of the banks. So you had no field of fire at all. Wonderful place to defend, but not much good for attacking. The tanks used to get in there and they couldn't get out because of these big banks. They did invent like a big shovel on the front of the tanks, which they fitted to some of the tanks, which could actually push the banks out to allow them to get back out of the fields again. But both us and the Americans had a lot of problem in the bocage. It's a beautiful country, but not to fight in.
How do you feel now about having served in the...
Oh, I'm very proud. And I'm still very much involved with the regiment. I mean, I go to reunions regularly. I've just been up to the Field of Remembrance only last Thursday. We gave it a day. And I go to every reunion I can. We did the three this year already. We've done numerous trips back to Normandy and gone all over the battlefields of Normandy. We've been back to Belgium, to Antwerp on two occasions, and we've been back to Holland on one big reunion we had in Holland. Because the big battle for the biggest battle we had in Holland really was the attack on Aston when we had to get across the canal, or the Willems Canal. That was pretty big. The Herefords lost a lot of men there because they got counterattacked before they could really get the bridgeheads organised, and they got very badly counterattacked. And the power lines came down, a lot of them got electrocuted with the power lines because the power was still running through the power lines.
Now, Aston's in the Peel country.
That's right.
And you're talking about September 1944.
Yep, that's right.
But yep. I don't really think that you've described your own part in that, please.
Probably not. Anyway, should we start from there?
Go yes,
from
please.
There? Well, we moved up to some fields which were close to the small town of Zomeren in the afternoon, and we stopped in those fields all night. The Hereford Regiment put the attack in across the Wilhelmine Canal at what was known as Sluice 11, where there was lock gates. The idea was that they would put in the attack and form a bridgehead, which would be about a mile wide and half a mile deep, which would allow the Royal Engineers to build a bailey bridge over the lock. Infantry could get across, but armour couldn't. So we had to get a bridge across to get the armour over. The other side of the lock, the road led away to the town of Aston. And that was the objective, to take Aston. The Herefords put this attack in late in the evening, and things went well for a start. And then they got very severely counterattacked. And the pylons came down, and a number got electrocuted. And this battle went on all night. And we were still in the fields to the Zomeren side of the canal. At first light, they managed to finish building the Bailey Bridge. The Royal Engineers had lost about half their complement in building this bridge. And the first three tanks, the trooper tanks of the 5th and 4th Yeomanry, which were one of our tank regiments, crossed the bridge, and all three were knocked out. The second troop of tanks managed to get over the bridge, and they had to literally push the knocked out tanks off the road to be able to get through. And immediately that happened, then D Company of the regiment were the first over the bridge. A Company was the last over. But eventually we pushed up the road towards Aston, and we had to clear the houses on the right-hand side of the road. And it was the only time that we ever did house clearing as we'd been taught in our training. The only time of the whole campaign where we cleared the houses from the back. And the road in front of the houses is known as the killing ground, where a tank was stationed at the end of the street, and anything that moved in that street he shot at. So you had to be very careful not to go out of the front door of the house. You work from the back all the time. And eventually, we, on the way up to this, the houses, there were dead Germans. I think there was a figure of 350 dead Germans in about half a mile of road, lying in the road, in the ditches, in the fields alongside the road. And I remember there was a German, and he had no top to his head. His head was totally blown away, the top of his head was. And right by his shoulder was sat a little white rabbit. And I picked this rabbit up and pushed it into my battle dress blouse and carried on with the fighting all day long until the evening. We were digging in on the far end of the town, and I suddenly thought to myself, what's this bulge under my jacket? And it was that little white rabbit. He'd been there all day. And I pulled him out and put him under a bush, and that was the last I saw him. We dug in, held the position all night. And next morning, one of my lads, looking down the road, he said, look at all these Germans coming to give themselves up. And there was a whole gaggle of Germans coming towards us. And I got the field glasses. He said, they're pulling a trolley, look. And I got the field glasses, and they weren't pulling a trolley, they were pulling a small anti-tank gun. And the tank that was on our right just stood there. I think they were all asleep in the tank, actually. I managed to wake them up and point down the road, and they fired the big gun and opened up with machine guns, and that stopped. It was a counterattack coming in, actually. That stopped the counterattack. And I remember it poured with rain all night long. And next morning, our trucks came up, our TCVs, and we got aboard the TCVs. And while we were sat in the square, the Germans put three shells through the clock on the town hall. Either the town hall or the church, I'm not sure which was which. Could have been the church. And we pulled out and we went to... I think we went to Helmond then for a rest. And that was the end of the battle, like, you know, the battle for Aston, which A Company adopted after the war when we moved into the barracks at Flensburg. Each company adopted the name of a town where they'd had a battle. And A Company adopted Aston, and that was on the outside of the company office, the name Aston.
Why did they choose that one?
Because that was one of our biggest battles, I suppose, as a company, like, you know, not as a battalion, but as a company, just as a company. Yeah.